there's a lot of concern with the process by which a product is made rather than the impact that it will have on human health or on the environment. And so I think that a forward-looking approach would be process agnostic, right? We shouldn't really care how we arrive at the creation of a new product, whether that be through CRISPR or through some other gene editing process, right? What should matter is the impact that it will actually make.
The bioeconomy, what is it? And why are we talking about it on China Talk? What's more, does America need a dash of industrial policy to support it? To discuss, we have on Ryan Fedashik, research fellow at CSET and adjunct at CNAS, as well as Gigi Granval, immunologist and professor at Johns Hopkins. The report we're going to be discussing today was funded by OSEA, the Air Force's Office of Commercial and Economic Analysis, which supports the Office of the Secretary of Defense in assessing commercial and economic risks to the defense industrial base. And this episode in particular was brought to you on China Talk Today by CNAS. After recording this show, Ryan joined the State Department, and disclaimer that the views he expressed on this episode are his own. Ryan and Gigi, welcome to China Talk. Gigi, what is biotech?
What is biotechnology? Well, it's a useful application of biology in its most general sense. So the biotechnologies, we are accustomed to thinking of them like medical biotechnologies. The COVID experience has demonstrated that vaccines are an amazing biotechnology, but there are biotechnologies that are not medical as well.
For instance?
Well, it's possible to use biology to make things that we eat, not just farming, but making beer or making impossible burgers. So burgers that taste like meat, but are not actually meat. It's possible to use biotechnologies to make building materials. It's possible to use biotechnologies to do mining instead of using caustic chemicals. It's possible to use biology to do the work for you.
And the bioeconomy, when did this phrase become a thing?
When did the bioeconomy become a thing? I think it became a thing when people realized that this was the technology that's going to drive us, that's going to drive economies in this century. And realizing that in order to have businesses that rely on biology and to lead in this world, you're going to need to have investments in the S&T development and the workforce and all these things to be able to sustain and grow businesses that rely on biotechnology.
And the sort of impetus for people realizing that, you know, this is something that's going to be particularly relevant in the 21st century, was this sort of technological breakthroughs, regulatory breakthroughs? What were the kind of building blocks for more and more folks to get convinced that this is something really important on the horizon?
I think for some decades now, people have been really thinking that biotechnology has tremendous power, but we haven't been able to really harness it. And I think every year that goes by, people think, oh, well, you've said that about bio before, that it's going to be super powerful. But every year, it does become more useful. The tools are being created to make it more powerful. So I think when you look back in the 70s, when people were starting to say, yes, biology is the future, we look back at the tools that they were able to use at that time and think, well, those are pretty rudimentary now in 2022. But yes, we've made a lot of progress over this time, and a lot of the dreams of the 1970s and 80s for biology are finally getting to be realized.
Can we get an example?
A lot of things that are possible. Well, so some of the tools that biology can use, like like building blocks of biology. So everybody is familiar with DNA, and you have a certain sequence, and every DNA is common across plants and animals. And in a certain sequence, codes for the organism. And it used to be that you could read biology, read DNA pretty well, but now you're able to also write DNA a lot better. And so you can, for example, synthesize an entire virus in the laboratory. And this has incredible useful qualities that you can design a vaccine. Of course, there's also security risks for this too.
Ryan, how do beets explain the bioeconomy?
So in Champagne, France, there's this biorefinery called the Bazancourt-Pommacle facility that processes like 3 million tons of beets a year. And there's a surprising amount of stuff you can do with sugar beets, which I think illustrates the various stages of bioprocessing that Gigi's been talking about. You can take beets and break them down into sugar. You can use that sugar for cooking or for fuel. You can break the sugar and other beet byproducts down into lignins, which are polymers that you can use then in animal feed, or you can mix to create concrete. You can break those lignins further down into acids and proteins that you can use to make nylon and other materials. And really, there are several questions that are embedded in this process. What are you doing with the waste from the beets? How are you harvesting and replanting the seeds? How are you growing bigger, better beets that give you more sugar and more lignin? And really, biotechnology at its current stage is about trying to answer those questions and trying to create bigger, better beets. And
that sounds great. Why do we need a national strategy for it?
I know I sound like Dwight Schrute over here or something, but no, because there are so many other applications that span, you know, things that go well beyond beets, that extend into food, medicine, materials, energy, industries that we can use to solve some of the country's most wicked challenges.
For instance,
you know, I think that there are a few discrete problems that, you know, the Biden administration's focused in on. Climate is one of them. The economy is another. Public health and trying to manage the COVID-19 response is another. Biotechnology is central to answering all of those, right? In terms of climate, we need alternative, cleaner sources of fuel. We've been trying to subsidize and bring from nothing a biofuels industry in this country for decades. And I think synthetic biology can actually help with scaling up those efforts, driving down costs, potentially making this a really competitive industry. On food, I think it's obvious, right? We can eat beets. You know, my heritage is Ukrainian. Got to do it all the time. But there are other foods we can grow and eat too, not just beets. There's something for everybody. But, you know, economically, though, I think there's the greatest promise. You know, we shouldn't make this all about risk or trying to mitigate the next pandemic, although that is a crucial component. There are just so many opportunities to create stuff we use every day. The clothes I'm wearing now could be used with, you know, beet nylon. Maybe that's a better branding campaign than, you know, some of the problems that Nike and H&M have been having in China. But, you know, there are an infinite number of supply chain questions and problems that could be solved by synthesizing new materials in the United States.
Another good reason for us to have a strategy when it comes to biotechnology is because other nations do have a strategy when it comes to biotechnology, and they're making progress in ways that that it's concerning for the U.S. that we might be falling behind or really losing the lead that we had. Synthetic biology, which you just mentioned, was created in the U.S. The ability to use biology to engineer, to provide engineering solutions to problems, that was a technology that came about in the U.S. and was supported in large part by government funding. And other nations have really dove in when it comes to synthetic biology. And they're also supporting the future workforce in ways that the U.S. is not doing as great a job at.
Let's flip the question a little bit. Like, without a national strategy, what is like the worst case of America's role in the global bioeconomy 20 years from now?
from my point of view, there is a serious risk of not being a first mover in a sector like biotechnologies, plural, where there are so many things we don't yet know that we don't yet know, right? When I'm thinking about what are the strategically consequential industries of the future, I'm thinking about technologies that have a relatively short-term, potentially precipitous impact that will do things and unlock potential that we don't yet fully appreciate down the road, and which are capital intensive, right? Which are not confined to digital space, where the risk of failure is more than opportunity cost. You can sink billions into something and lose. And that's really where we're playing very high stakes in strategic technological competition with China, those kinds of industries, quantum information science, alternative sources of energy in terms of green technology, and of course, biotechnologies. And so that is why this seems like a particularly salient industry to focus on, because there are simply capabilities that seem like they will be coming down the tracks in the next 10, 20 years that I think it would behoove the United States to be the first mover and the leader in. We've seen ourselves fail time and time again in industries like telecommunications, industries like solar supply chains, which Chinese companies now dominate. And I think that was a mistake to kind of look the other way or to believe that innovating and spreading a bunch of breakthrough technologies without necessarily commercializing them and bringing them to market, to believe that that strategy was going to pay off.
This kind of comes to the central question of this, right? Is like, look, you're not going to be self-reliant and leading in everything. And the one that you didn't mention, which is generally when people think about, oh, what are strategic, you know, what are like the strategic industries of the future, is dual use, right? And stuff like the solar industry, not super dual use. I mean, like, yeah, on the margin, like it'd be, you know, so you have some solar panels on a, you know, cruiser or something, but the vast majority of that is not the end of the world, I think, if the U.S. is if the U.S. is relying on other countries. And then it's sort of like the question of where you draw the line around, if it's just a play of like, look, these are going to be big industries which will drive a lot of, you know, growth and tax revenue. That's a totally reasonable, and like, you know, you could have a small down payment as a nation and then sort of reap the benefits going down the road. Like that's one argument. But I guess the question where you start branching out from, you know, arms and space capabilities and like chips that go into your fighter jets, and start going further and further away from like the core military technologies. It's an interesting question for me, where you draw the line, or if it's not really a line, it's just kind of like a spectrum of to what extent the government should be, you know, supporting domestic industry and comfortable with internationalization and reliance on global supply chains, and, you know, supply chains that run through countries like China in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think for people who are worried that the U.S. is going to fall behind in biotechnology, it's especially concerning because biology is such a comprehensive technology. It's not like just solar panels that do a particular function. Bio could be applied to so many different things, and to fall behind in such a foundational technology is problematic for the economic security of the future. Also, militaries will need to use biology to do lots of different things that they might rely upon petroleum-based chemistries, you know, now that they should be branching out and not being so dependent on petroleum for. So I think it's a degree of scale. I mean, biotechnology is just so much more useful, has so many more applications than many other technologies, and the consequences of falling behind, I think, could be more drastic. And we see what happens when countries have not invested in the same way during COVID. For example, there are countries who were not at the front of the vaccine line that because they did not have a pharmaceutical industry. And we see how that affects the health of people in those nations. So, I mean, it's having the technology within the U.S. is, I think, important for medical purposes, but other things too.
I would add one corollary to this, which is if there's anything we've learned from experiences in other strategic sectors, it's that it's about more than technology and market share. It's about infrastructure. It's about building things that can be repurposed in a crisis, or supply chains that are resilient to shock, or facilities that are able to mode switch quickly. When we're talking about biotechnologies, it's not just a matter of who is supplying the service and who is buying it from whom. It's about where we are building supply chains to procure genetic resources and material, who is sequencing that material and those kinds of DNA, where we're storing that information, who is providing synthesis as a service, whether that's through physical hardware or through some other means, and then who is ultimately able to make discoveries of novel molecules and create novel materials first. And so it's not just a race to be the first in many of these applications, although I think that is important. It's also ensuring your long-term access and that none of those steps in bioprocessing can be weaponized later on.
Judy, let's talk a little bit about talent development domestically and competing for it globally. How important is it, and what is and isn't being done, and what more work needs to be done on this front?
Yeah, we have a lot that we can do to increase our workforce for biotechnology and be smarter about it. First of all, we train a lot of people in the United States. We in biotechnology, we have people who come over from all over the world to get graduate degrees, to get PhDs, to do postdoctoral fellowships at leading research institutions. And then we say goodbye and help them leave the country and go somewhere else to start their business, to start their lab, to continue their research. And while that's great for them to be able to go home, I would like it so that they could be encouraged to stay here in the United States and to be able to start a biotech company, to continue their work here. And I think that if we are investing in people to train them, that we should make it easier for them to stay in the U.S. And that's kind of a no-brainer. A lot of people have said this, that we should, you know, hand out green cards with PhDs. And that's, I think, a good idea. Then the other thing that we need to do is think about how we're educating students. There are a lot of great programs out there, and I don't want to make generalizations about how we train students, because there are certainly a lot of scientists who have gotten a great education, but we're not doing enough to give students experiential learning in the laboratory and to teach them scientific principles and really get into the science and how exciting it can be. And very often classes in college that people take to get into biology are like weeding out classes. You know, it's trying to separate out the people who are going to take the MCATs and go to medical school, and they'll memorize 10 phone books if you give them 10 phone books to memorize, versus people who actually do not want to go to medical school, but want to go into science. And these are two different tracks that sometimes go at cross purposes educationally. And so giving the people who want to do science opportunities to excel, to work in laboratories, and to actually do research is not something that's been a priority. And it has been a priority for other countries.
Ryan, what's the Bayh-Dole Act and why does it matter?
Yeah, Bayh-Dole is a cornerstone of the U.S. IP regime as we know today. So before 1980, if the federal government had input any money in developing like a patent or a copyright at a research institution or a university, then the government reserved the first right to bring that innovation to market. But typically it didn't. And so a lot of innovations, a lot of IP basically sat in the archives of universities and research institutions unable to be brought to market, unable to be commercialized. The Bayh-Dole Act changed that. It allowed individuals who were working at research projects at universities, and it allowed universities themselves to own the rights to IP that they generated using federal R&D dollars. And so there have been a tremendous number of products and breakthroughs, including the mRNA vaccine that we're using to combat COVID-19, that were products of federal R&D dollars that were allowed to be brought to market through the Bayh-Dole Act. So, you know, I think I wrote some notes in preparation for this pod. And former Undersecretary of Commerce Walter Koppen estimated that basically since it was passed in 1980, Bayh-Dole has led to over $1 trillion in economic growth and created more than 4 million jobs as a result of creating basically just thousands of new startups out of a university IP. This is particularly important because it has direct bearing on biotechnologies today and on the broader bioeconomy. There are just so many products or processes that have grown out of university research that are now becoming startups based in Silicon Valley, but also based in Miami, based in Boston, in other bioengineering hubs in Texas. And so this is directly creating a lot of the new innovations we're seeing in the field using processes like CRISPR.
So Ryan, in your paper, you run through some, you know, like metrics for grading the U.S. relative to the rest of the world on, you know, how many companies are getting founded, how many PhDs are being created. It seems like, you know, I'm a little less stressed out about this than I am about, you know, battery production or what have you. Would you say are the emerging risks and, you know, overall rationale for the government getting more involved and updating a regulatory and legal system, which, like, you know, it seems like it's doing okay, as well as spending more money in a industrial policy-esque fashion towards the bioeconomy?
Sure. So I the bottom line of Regenerate, the report I did for CNAS, is yes, we're doing all right, but there are actually some worrying signs on the wall, right? It's not a feature of the report. The intent was not to fearmonger, but if you look at organizations like the Beijing Genomics Institute, BGI, it's now a leading producer of COVID test kits. Chinese vaccines like Sinovac and Sinopharm are really dominant in Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia. Over the past 3 to 5 years, compared to the United States, Chinese institutions have been producing way more CRISPR-based plant genome editing studies. I think China now accounts for 40% of publications in that space globally. And so there are some things that are starting to change. And we already talked about the growing talent gap. So yes, the United States seems to lead in market share. We have more biotechnology startups and enterprises. We have a pretty free intellectual property system that rewards innovators. These are all good things. But we also have seen the Chinese government put a premium on producing patents writ large and also in biotechnologies. Biotechnologies are a staple of the 14th Five-Year Plan. They're one of the seven technologies that the Chinese government has said that they will focus on during this next period. And I think that China really is making progress. So my plea to your listeners is to not be complacent with the current status of the United States. And more than this, I fear that there are certain ways we could really run amok very quickly, whether that is losing access to an important equipment supply chain like steel for fermentation units, or whether it is, lying to ourselves about how innovative we truly are relative to China and suddenly falling behind in the production of information or access to genomic data.
Let's stay on steel for a second. I mean, steel? You know, that was the one paragraph in your paper where I was like, man, we are really expanding our universe of what is what is worthy of protection if like the what we're banging into vats to grow algae is something that is now considered a strategic resource. Convince me that I'm wrong, Ryan.
The strongest version of the argument for why you should care about steel is if you really think, as I somewhat do, that biotechnology really will revolutionize the economy, that we're going to be growing tons of stuff that we will use to create concrete and mycelium for construction projects, and this is going to be the backbone of a lot of goods and services in the next 20 years, we're going to need a large, large amount of space to grow all kinds of microbes and to ferment stuff, sugars from all the beets we're going to be eating. And to do that, you need tons of space, and specifically you need tons of steel fermentation units to reuse over and over and over again. And to put them everywhere. And I will just say, you know, look at the price of steel, which has increased 50% in the past 5 years. Look at long-term trajectory of U.S. steel production. The United States is a leading importer of steel. We import almost $20 billion worth of the stuff every year. China is the leading exporter. It's worth more than $30 billion. And U.S. domestic steel production has stayed flat at about 7 million tons of steel for the past decade.
But that's like because it's not economical to make steel in America. And the only reason we make it in the first place, right, is like because we've had protectionist policy protecting, you know, our steel workers for the past 30 years. So
let me walk it back a little bit. Okay. Because I gave you, you know, the maximalist position. Like, honestly, yeah, we should import steel. The United States does not need to be a leading steel exporter or producer. I'm just saying we just need to figure out what our alternative supply chains ought to be if we expect the economic relationship to continue to deteriorate and tariffs to be leveled. It's going to be harder to get materials like steel.
So, you know, Mao is also really into making steel. And I say that not as a like, yes, with a little bit of facetiousness in my voice, but also I think it's a broader lesson on when you set targets on the wrong thing, you actually lead to a lot of awful distortion. And you know, the worst example of this, of course, is the Great Leap Forward, where like they didn't even prioritize the right steel, and people were like melting their pans and farm equipment into stuff that was completely worthless. So this is clearly not where America is by any shape or means, or even anything you said in your paper, Ryan. But it goes to say that like you have to be careful with this stuff when you start getting the US government more and more involved in industry, because there are ways in which you can really distort incentives in the marketplace, which lead very far, which actually, you know, help and end up doing more harm than good.
Can I push back on that a little bit, though? I mean, yes, I think you're right that the U.S. government, when it comes to biotechnology, they have not wanted in general to pick winners or losers here. But, you know, there are some things that biology provides that that the U.S. government is not going to get if they wait for the market to produce it. Sure. And so they have taken pretty aggressive measures to be able to have, for example, vaccines available for smallpox, which are now being applied for monkeypox, and making sure that companies that produce these types of vaccines diagnostics are available and are able to stay afloat. And we're going to probably have to do the same thing with diagnostics, because we're going to need to be able to have diagnostic tests available when diseases emerge, and not some months after they emerge.
Let me hit you with a transition to safety from your Mao example. So I agree. We shouldn't be creating steel mills in our backyards. And in fact, one proposal out there is to try to democratize access to things like DNA synthesis and to create, you know, garage level biotechnology laboratories. It's a fine balance trying to concentrate access to really important equipment and materials, and then also trying to like democratize access to the technology in general.
It is hard. There was a great Wired article, this is years ago, but it stuck with me, about talking to Nobel laureates in chemistry and how they got their start. And a lot of these Nobel laureates got their start by burning up their garages, you know, and they did really dangerous things and blew stuff up. And we do not want that to happen with the corollary with biology, but you do need to have some things that are fun, that draw people in. And there are those things with biology, that people can do things that, you know, it's more than just taking the DNA out of strawberries, and which I assume both of you have tried to do that. It's a fun experiment you can do in your kitchen. But things like, you know, there are things that one can do that are fun. And there are these community laboratories that it can help people have that experience without, and the danger, you know, having a little bit of adult supervision, having access to equipment and skills, having a good group environment, but not, you know, not the danger. There's one in Baltimore called the Baltimore Underground Science Center, or BUGS, and they do a lot of education for high schoolers, but also people in the community, and they have talks and people get together for beers on Friday. It's a really great group of people, but they have really high biosafety standards, and that's what you need to be able to educate people about biotechnology.
So, you know, coming into that bio risk, how does the evolution of technology sort of change the risk matrix going forward?
Biology can be a very powerful tool, and we can see how that biology, like we've seen with COVID, that a virus, a biological package, there's always a big debate over whether viruses are alive or not. That was why I was hesitating and how I was describing viruses, but like my training was, you know, was that they were not alive. They're like symbionts. But anyway, it doesn't matter. We all know it doesn't matter if they're alive or not. Viruses can cause a tremendous amount of damage. And we've seen this over the last couple of years with COVID. We're going to see a lot more of these emerging infectious diseases in the years, especially because of climate change and all kinds of terrible things that we're doing to our planet and environment. But these things don't just exist in nature. It is possible for people to manipulate these biological organisms. We have been very fortunate in our history that while there are nations that have poured a ton of money into biological weapons programs, we have not seen a whole lot of use of those programs. And so, for example, the Soviet Union and then Russia employed thousands of scientists to make weapons out of smallpox and anthrax, tularemia, and they were ready to use them, but thankfully they didn't.
The current American regulatory environment, what does it get right and wrong when it comes to fostering a strong bioeconomy?
We have this process of regulating the production of new, if you want to call them genetically modified or genetically engineered biotechnology products as they enter the market, right? We have the coordinated framework for the regulation of biotechnology. It was created in 1984, been updated a few times since then. But basically it is a fairly convoluted process that is co-managed by the USDA, the FDA, and the EPA. Which jointly regulate and approve new stuff. And I think, you know, my opinion is that it's good. We should make sure that, you know, when we sell products or when we try to plant crops that are engineered in some new fashion, that they're not going to poison the water supply, or that they're not going to, spread like wildfire and become an invasive species. These are good things, and we should worry about those impacts. However, one of the problems with the way this coordinated framework is implemented is that it's extremely unclear about to whom individual companies ought to report new products, because you have all kinds of newly fashioned, you know, microbes that also produce chemicals that are used both for agriculture and for cooking. And so they're overlapping jurisdictions, number one. And number two, there's a lot of concern with the process by which a product is made rather than the impact that it will have on human health or on the environment. And so I think that, a forward-looking approach would be process agnostic, right? We shouldn't really care how we arrive at the creation of a new product, whether that be through CRISPR or through some other gene editing process, right? What should matter is the impact that it will actually make.
Yeah, that was an attempt to overhaul the coordinated framework and make it a little bit more, to be more predictable to companies, because, you know, it's a little simplistic to say like companies don't want any regulation. That's not true. They want to know what they're going to be facing, right? They want to know what kind of regulation is going to be affecting their products and they can prepare for it. And it is very confusing to know which of these agencies is going to be primarily regulating your product right now. There was an attempt to overhaul the coordinated framework at the end of the second Obama administration. And I think they thought that they were going to have a little more time for that process, and they didn't. And so they tried to wrap things up really quickly, and it didn't. It just left the job not completely done.
What is a Manhattan Project for biology?
I don't know if that's like the best analogy, because, you know, we would like to, I think people talk to use that sort of terminology when it comes to like making a COVID vaccine, you know, a focused effort, throw all the money at it. Why use, you know, lead when gold will do, sort of, you know, everything, no expense too high. And if that's what you mean, then I think that's a good, that could be a good analogy. But Manhattan Project seems, considering it was, you know, focused on developing a pretty terrible weapon, I don't think that that's really applicable to biology.
Everybody I used that phrase with complained about it and said basically exactly what Gigi has just said. But here's my defense of a, not actually a defense, but like for some perspective, right? The Manhattan Projects employed, what, like 130,000 people and cost the equivalent of $20 billion today. And we just gave two of those to the semiconductor industry. So I do think that that's the level that we should be playing at in terms of the amount of money and the significance that we attach to the problems that biotechnology can solve. But I also think that we can be more targeted and strategic in the way that we devote that capital and to which applications, right? I actually think, and you know, I'm going to get criticized for this, but I'm ready. A pretty interesting model that we could possibly learn some lessons from are mega projects that the Chinese government is undertaking and developing, right? Some proof of concept, flashy thing. I'm thinking, why not try to build a city block from mycelium, or try to print some concrete structure using concrete that is coming from microorganisms and generating itself, right? Something to attract, to number one, inspire the public imagination, but number two, continue attracting and sustaining venture capital interest in various emerging technologies.
Gigi, can you talk a little bit about some of the similarities and differences between American and Chinese approaches to biosafety?
I think China has emulated U.S. approaches to biosafety for decades now in a lot of ways. Like, for example, early on when genetic engineering became a thing that we did, we had these review committees that were based in research institutions to review experiments and to give their blessing, look over biosafety protocols, decide which kind of experiments need to be in what kind of containment. And that system was emulated by China and many other countries as well. And so, you know, the U.S. in being a leader in biotechnology also helped promulgate their system of regulation throughout the world as well. And that's another good reason to keep our foot on the gas, you know, and still lead in this area. I've visited labs in China and India, Malaysia, you know, Benin, Togo, all over the world. A lot of the international standards are pretty similar. There's definitely a variety of supply differences. You know, a lot of places do not have access to the same materials. But I didn't see a big difference in approach to biosafety. That's not the case everywhere in the world, but I didn't see a big difference in the approach to biosafety between China and the U.S.
Ryan, what recommendations do you have for us?
If we look at each of these four resources, equipment, personnel, information, and capital, there are some clear priorities, which might not stand out in the report as it's written. But first of all is personnel. We need more talented people in this country to be not just PIs and work at tenure-track research positions at universities, but to fill jobs that don't yet exist in the bioeconomy, and their presence will create a pressure to create them. And so I think that Congress should, first of all, vote to codify this recent expansion in STEM OPT, the optional practical training program. We recently significantly increased the number of people who are allowed to stay on STEM OPT and extended the duration from 2 to 3 years. I think that's great. Why not institutionalize it, which would take an act of Congress? And I think that's what Congress should do. I think in terms of capital, we need more money. I feel like Mona Lisa Saperstein from Parks and Rec, like, money, please. But honestly, that is what we need to sustain progress in biotechnologies. And so I say in the report that Congress should authorize significant increases in the budgets of tech incubators, like the Small Business Innovation Research Program, which is run by a lot of federal agencies. But why not give more money to USDA, FDA, EPA, NIH to do more with their current funding, and then also defense applications through like DARPA and NQTEL. The last one I'll throw at you, at least for now, is about the way we handle genomic data and information. This is something that is of incredible importance to the Chinese government. My colleagues at the Center for Security and Emerging Technology are working on a lot of research right now about exactly what that looks like. But I will just say, I think that in the United States, the National Institutes of Health should create a gene bank that is really equipped for 21st century genomic research. We have a gene bank. It's updated maybe monthly. The user interface is terrible. And the process by which people can access that information and the contents of what's currently in that bank are just not adequate. I think one clear change, for example, could be to try to open up a lot of the data that the Food and Drug Administration holds right now as a result of reviewing so many applications for new products and so many tests that it conducts itself. I think researchers should be allowed to access some of that, at least at universities and at trusted research institutions, if not the private sector.
Gigi, what are some of the dumbest things you've heard people propose to do with the American bioeconomy? Ryan's Ryan's Manhattan Project accepted, of course.
Well, I'm just thinking back to, I think most people recognize that the bioeconomy is important. And I think what they don't understand is they don't have enough scientific expertise to understand, to have a good vision for how consequential it can be, and also to make good decisions. So my big recommendation is that there needs to be more scientific expertise and leadership, and not just people who are like head of NIH, because of course you're going to have a scientific leader that's head of NIH, but people who are like in the White House, not just dealing with biotechnology, but that have this expertise in their background. What I mean is that people who are training to be national security professionals need to have a lot more biology in their education, and they need to understand what it is, because it's going to be such an important part of our future. And I think bad decisions or bad suggestions come from this lack of expertise. And I think I've heard just about every bad suggestion when it comes to COVID in the last several years. And so it's really hard to pick just one thing that I've heard. But I think it comes from, you know, a lot of things that I've heard come from smart people who are smart about lots of different things, but not about biology. And so when you lack these fundamentals, you're not going to, you know, be smart in that area.
Is there like a particular way in which people are wrong, or do you think there's something about folks being more overconfident about biology because, like, you know, we're humans and, like, I don't know, we take drugs, as opposed to semiconductors, where folks maybe have a better sense of just how confusing and foreign electrical engineering is to anything they've ever encountered before. Where do you think the overconfidence comes from, Gigi? Or do you think it's just an endemic thing?
I think there's a few things that are a problem. I don't know if people just assume that they don't understand a semiconductor. They know it's a thing that, like, that they just they're going to put in the too hard box and not worry about it. Whereas biology touches our lives a little bit more directly, and so people have stronger opinions about it, even if they're wrong. So I think, sure. You know, some basic things that, like, microorganisms grow, they replicate. These are people kind of miss that that biology is different than other engineering disciplines because they, you know, biology is, well, the other thing that people don't understand is that there's a lot we don't know. And people think that, you know, we are a lot more advanced than people were 100 years ago when dealing with 1918 flu. And that is true. But there's still a whole lot of biology out there that we are just learning about. And I think that people miss how much we have yet to discover.
Ryan and Gigi, I close every show with a song. Do you have a biotech song up your sleeve, by any chance?
I was thinking, and I don't have one. I dropped you a link to some Chinese rap that I like, but that's it.
I don't know. I've just been, like, having Beyonce's Renaissance, like, on repeat, and I can't think of anything that's, I mean, there's a lot of, like, biologically adjacent topics, but not of this.
Yeah. Emma. Fair enough. Ryan and Gigi, thanks so much for being a part of Chinatown.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Jordan. This war is for Stella, is cook, is for chopper, chopper, simple. You watch Jim Moose on Ocean Dowley, study there. How you something good? Something cool, so what's the chest? Shang Ching so, what's the chest?
比上眼我视力会更好点儿，昨晚没找他来话就冷气更早点儿，如果不扰民的话还可以再更吵点儿，虽然起覆盖玻璃他影子变更耀眼，我用我耳朵发现美，动力自然动力气，决定弄个名堂出来就必须要弄彻底，谦虚的同时还有氧，我们不仅能够下起风还有浪，一切在卡卡狗狗头软，现在在台面上喊，我 verse 太辣才骂帮我的调料必须放慢，宝宝长菜给我兄弟伙心爱的放宽，中文说唱我永远都是个最好的样板，听Eddie说这是需要我来争几段，我的 hater 听了直接送到生意外，我信手拈来，这别拍flow就像个天才，这 rap game 从来不是在比哪个先来，强者才能够生存，你的 rap 太乱都还不够身份，我戴个马尔狗吃 no cat 才最真诚，在耶稣福的夫妻新年要远离瘟神，This war is for Stanley is cook is for chopper chopper simple 一话节目让我想到嘞 study 脸还有 something good something cool 说话之前想清楚我发现闭上眼我视力会更好点儿昨晚没找他的话就能起更早点儿如果不扰民的话还可以再更吵点儿随身起覆盖玻璃他影子变更耀眼儿。
Hey there, China Talk listeners. This is Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Jill Weisenthal, and we are the co-hosts of Bloomberg's Odd Lots podcast.
Yep, and if you enjoy China Talk, we think that you'll like Odd Lots too.
We have engaging conversations on everything from semiconductors to trade to AI to macroeconomic policy, and we always have the perfect guest.
Yep, you can check us out at Odd Lots on all the podcast platforms or Bloomberg.com/Odd Lots.